coming up on the Inside Indiana Business Television podcast. How are supply chain issues hitting Indiana? A homegrown environmental reporting company is gaining accolades. We make a visit to one of the state's most endangered places. The Children's Museum has a new leader. The produce moms want you to eat your vegetables. Muncie schools are looking to bridge the achievement gap. We check in on the Fort Wayne Comets, and our partnership with IBJ takes another step forward. Welcome to the Inside Indiana Business Television Podcast. I'm Andy Ober. You've certainly heard about, and you may have experienced issues with the national supply chain bottleneck. It's having a substantial impact on the economy and could be an even bigger problem in a manufacturing-heavy state like Indiana. Integrated Distribution Services CEO Mark DeFabis joined Inside Indiana Business host Gary Dick with Insight.
Your company, a longtime third-party logistics company here in Indiana, you're on the front lines here. Mark, give us an idea. We hear about the supply chain crisis every day, but some examples you're seeing out there of Indiana manufacturers, retailers, and others who are really impacted by this.
Yeah, certainly manufacturers are having a hard time getting component parts, especially if they're coming from overseas. And retailers now trying to get products from overseas in for holiday season. But I think as typical, this is not the first time that supply chains have seen disruptions. So you're seeing many manufacturers and other retailers trying to, how do you overcome those disruptions? And that's usually with alternative means of transportation. It's usually dedicated. So they're either having to fly it in on planes, you're having a dedicated truck to bring it in, or even in some cases, dedicated ocean vessels to bring their containers in. But all that does is really add to inflation because the cost to circumvent from that standpoint is very, very expensive.
Yeah. So if you're a manufacturer, your company here in Indiana, and you're wanting to get a container from the West Coast here, what would be a normal wait time for that to happen versus what we're seeing now because of the supply chain issues?
Yeah, from the West Coast, almost every container has to go through Chicago before it's going to get to Indianapolis. We don't have a direct route. In a typical time, a wait time in Chicago's rail yards to get a container off onto a chassis so it can be transported down south would be about 3 days. Now you're seeing wait time significantly longer than that, and I think it's going to get even worse.
Yeah, and as you look at, Mark, obviously the truck driver shortage, the real issues in that industry, that began certainly before the pandemic and before this did, but exacerbated by this now, this truck driver. What can be done, in your view, as an executive in the industry? What would you like to see done to address some of these issues?
Well, really, it's all about velocity. We need to keep product moving in the supply chain. And of course, the vast majority of that moves by truck. Because we're not going to, I think, magically create more truck drivers overnight, we need to look at hours of service. Can those drivers that we currently have work maybe an hour or two longer because of all the dwell time that they have? The big thing is the Drive Safe Act, which has been in Congress since early this year, which would allow 18 to 21 year olds to drive across state lines. I mean, right now they can drive an 18 wheeler from South Bend to Evansville, but they can't go from Evansville into Kentucky, which is a little ridiculous. That we need to do some innovative things in the short term like that to really be able to have more velocity within the supply chain.
Yeah, Mark, everyone wants to know, you know, when this is going to end or when it's going to get better. I know you and I were talking off camera before the interview. You don't think that's going to be anytime soon?
No, I think if you look at it, the issues that we have are not going to clear themselves overnight. We're not going to, within the next year, have hundreds, if not thousands, of more truck drivers. We're not going to have hundreds of thousands more trucks. You're not going to have more, thousands and hundreds of thousands of more chassis to pull containers. It's going to be a while before we work out of this. Now, there will be workarounds, and I think we'll continue to see manufacturers and retailers do workarounds for the bottlenecks that we have in the supply chain. But again, it's just going to be more expensive in the long run.
Yeah. Mark, you're a board member at Kinexus Indiana, that organization that is very supportive of the advanced manufacturing and logistics industries here. I know Kinexus Congress is going to be involved in a listening event next week with members of the Indiana congressional delegation. What do you anticipate that conversation is going to be like? And is there a message or messages that will be delivered to the delegation?
Absolutely. Senator Braun and Senator Young have been gracious enough to host this event as a listening session so that we will have Indiana-based manufacturers as well as logistics companies to talk about the real world problems that we're facing with the supply chain and really present to our delegation practical solutions, both some short term, some long term, that we need to start pursuing in order to correct this. Message that we hope to carry, and I think Indiana is well positioned. Kinexus has done some studies already. We're about to complete another one about commodity movement, so we can take care of the bottlenecks and the issues that we have within the state. But the message that we're going to try to communicate to our congressional delegation, it's about velocity. We have to keep things moving in the supply chain.
All right. Mark DeFabe is CEO at Integrated Distribution Services. Mark, some great perspective on this very difficult issue. Mark, thanks very much. I hope to see you soon.
Thanks, Gary.
Indianapolis-based NCAMP is growing and gaining statewide accolades. The company bills itself as an innovative environmental compliance and reporting platform. CEO Luke Jacobs came on the show to share his story.
Before we get into some cool things happening there at NCAMP, give us the business model, environmental health and safety compliance software, right? Give us a thumbnail what the company is all about.
Yeah, happy to. So I think the easiest way to think about it, especially for your average person, is that we function a lot like TurboTax, but for environmental rules scaled up to the enterprise level. So big companies need to track requirements that they have to maintain at a state level, at a federal level for environmental reporting. And then once they actually know what they need to report, they need to track the data and they need to submit the data to the right agencies. We're a software company that really takes an end-to-end approach with that entire process with our customers to work with them to not only establish the facility foundations, but then actually complete final reporting in an ongoing basis for them.
Yeah, and we were talking off camera, Luke, you really feel it's your secret sauce, if you will. You've got the software, you've got the technology, but it's that support kind of behind the technology that is really helping to fuel growth.
Yeah, absolutely, Gary. So one of the, I think, key elements of our business is that we staff our customer success team and support teams with people who have direct experience working as environmental consultants. This is actually my background before I was thinking about really starting a company. I was working as an environmental professional, and I truly believe we bring the next generation of technology to this space, but then we do layer that in with just an elite team of environmental specialists who work really closely and carefully with our customers to ensure that not only is the software doing what they need it to do, but that they're supported along the way, which I think is it's really bared out actually and shown its value not only in our customer acquisition, but once our customers get in the encampment with us and start using our software, they basically stick around and they often grow. So we have really strong net retention across the customer base. And I think that really is because of the people that we have supporting the customers.
Yeah. And your customers are big time players. You started out and still have, I think, some smaller mom and pop customers, but you're dealing with some of the biggest companies in the world.
That's correct. Yeah. We have customers all the way from some local ag retailers in Kentucky that I drove to myself and got some deals done early on, all the way up into the Fortune 50 at this point, have numerous Fortune 50 customers.
Hey, Luke, talk about what's next. 800% revenue growth in 2020. You raised $12 million in a Series B round you closed on earlier this year. 60-plus employees. Where do you see things going that you're really on a growth trajectory?
Yeah, it's been a ride for sure, and we're really grateful for all the growth that we've experienced. At this point for this year, our growth really hasn't been slowing down. We're over 400% year-over-year growth for this year, and if you kind of think about the numbers, it gets harder to continue growing faster the bigger you get. So the growth has really continued, and we're projecting to end the year at over 500%. Really, as I'm looking to 2022, 2023, for us, it's expanding our customer base, continuing to move up market and serving these really large enterprises to help them manage their environmental compliance. And it's really building out additional reporting capabilities from our system. There are a lot of regulations. We've started with a targeted segment, and there's a logical progression along our product roadmap to really eventually become the operating system for the entire space is our ultimate goal. So a lot of work ahead. We'll be hiring more engineers, more salespeople, more customer success pretty much across the board.
Okay. I know you're a native Hoosier and a big supporter of the Indianapolis tech scene, and you're glad you're growing the Indiana tech scene, growing it here. Luke Jacobs, the CEO, co-founder at InCamp. Congratulations, and we look forward to seeing you soon.
Fantastic. Thank you, Gary.
Each year, Indiana Landmarks highlights 10 historically significant places in the state on the brink of extinction. Among this year's selections is the Tipton County Jail and Residence. Around Indiana reporter Mary Rachel Redman has the story on what it will take to save this piece of Indiana history.
The former Tipton County Jail and Sheriff's Residence turned 126 years old this year, and it's still standing. Not only the structure, but as a repeat offender on Indiana Landmark's 10 Most Endangered list. And that celebrated architect you mentioned is Adolph Shearer, the same guy that designed Indiana State Capitol Building and a host of other famous Hoosier mainstays around the turn of the century, including the Tipton County Jail and Sheriff's Residence.
Concrete floors, steel beds, and bars. It wouldn't leave you with the warm and fuzzies. Kind of scary, in fact.
Not exactly the words you'd think someone might use to describe a building they're hoping to save. But the Tipton County Jail and Sheriff's Residence is steeped in history. A landmark in a town starved for architectural ties to its past.
We have so few buildings here left in our county that are actually of historical significance.
It was the last operating sheriff's residence and jail in the state of Indiana.
But that historic run came to an end earlier this year.
They made the decision to build a new jail several years ago, and that construction just completed, and they moved all the prisoners from this structure into the new jail. So this one became vacant.
And Tipton residents are determined to save it.
It's a beautiful structure. Much of the original woodwork is still intact with a beautiful fireplace, wood mantle still there. There are some original electric fixtures.
This is the upstairs of the sheriff's residence.
At the end of the 19th century, several state governments, especially in the Midwest, required sheriffs to live next door to the county jail. And in the case of Tipton County, the sheriff's family residence was actually attached to the jail. When this residence opened in 1895, it was then lived in all the way to 2006.
It tells us what life was like in the 1890s and the early 1900s. Once treasures like that are gone, they're gone forever. It would be too expensive to try to reproduce a building like this.
I'd like to see it turned into something that the community can come through. Maybe take part in some type of retail experience that also exposes them to a display of our past. We all can learn from what's taken place in our history and where we came from. That's my hope, is how we can incorporate it.
A feasibility study released in October estimates a rehab of the site would cost upwards of $2 million. And according to that study, the most expensive rehab costs would come from all new electrical, mechanical, and plumbing. But perhaps the biggest win, it was found to be more expensive to tear it down rather than restore this historic landmark. But no final decisions have been made on the future of the jail. One notable expense not accounted for, though, is the uptick in cost of building materials due to the current supply chain crisis you mentioned at the top of the show.
One of Indianapolis's most iconic and popular cultural destinations has a new leader. Jennifer Pace Robinson is the new president and chief executive officer of the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. She joined us to talk about her new role.
You have been at the museum for a long time, almost three decades. You have seen a lot. You've seen the institution evolve and change and grow. As you think back on the past 29 plus years, what are your thoughts for the next number of years? And how do you see that your experiences shaping your vision for the museum?
Right. So the first thing that always comes to mind is let's do more. Let's do more of the same. We have walked in some really wonderful footsteps of previous leaders. The vision of one of our first leaders, Mrs. Compton, to create this building that we're in now and these huge 10,000 square foot galleries. And so I really see my role to capitalize on the work that has come before and just keep pushing it forward. So you'll see lots of engaging activities for preschoolers, for families. We're going to be a tourist destination to come during the holiday season, during spring break. We're going to continue our international relationships and make more international relationships because that really allows us to bring the world to Indianapolis through our Take Me There exhibits. And on the horizon, we've got some really big dinosaur bones.
Yeah, yeah. What in your roles at the museum, you've really grown up there, literally an interpreter, an exhibit manager. You were the lead originally on Dinosphere, and that's going through another iteration. So some of those tried and true exhibits are going to remain.
Right. And that's so important to our business that we know, for example, with dinosaurs, almost 90% of the people who walk through our doors go into the Dinosphere exhibit. And when we started that experience, we did so much market study of what do kids want to see when they walk in the door? And dinosaurs is right there near the top. And so creating that Cretaceous world was amazing. Working with the advisors, we've been digging for the last 5 years on a top secret site out in Wyoming called the Jurassic Mile. And so that's what we're doing next. We're going to be repurposing the space so you feel like you're traveling back in time to the Jurassic world, and you're going to be encountering the giant specimens that come out of that space. Yeah. So a lot of very cool things. And things are different now. You know, when I project managed the original opening in 2004, technology has come so far. So that confluence of amazing real objects, but also the backdrops and the sound and the light that you can use now really will help people feel like they're somewhere new.
Yeah, Jennifer, obviously COVID has impacted all of our lives, business, industry, you name the segment of the economy. How has it impacted the museum world, if you will, especially going forward? Has it changed the way you're going to be doing business?
Right. So a couple of pretty amazing things have come out of what has been a very hard time for lots of institutions. But the sense of community and sharing our successes and our wins and what hasn't worked has really kind of gelled the field as a community and kind of a really great way. And going forward, we're really talking about the mix of the virtual and the on-site. And one thing that I found out is it takes just as many people to do the virtual as it does to do the on-site. And so making sure that we have that right mix, because we were able to reach families in England and schools in Kentucky. And let's keep that momentum going, but make sure that we look at all the resources we have available and that we reserve enough for those in-person visitors who are starting to come back again.
Jennifer Pace Robinson, the new CEO at the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. Jennifer, thanks so much. You've got a lot of energy, and I know a lot of great ideas. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you so much.
Remember, you can catch Inside Indiana Business Television on stations throughout the state every weekend. Head to InsideIndianaBusiness.com to check listings. In 2012, Indy native Lori Taylor set out to get people to eat more fruit and vegetables. Less than 10 years later, the Produce Moms has grown into a global platform that promotes healthy eating. Taylor spoke with Kylie Valletta in the business of health.
Well, we'll talk about your newest business deal in just a minute, but first, give us an idea how the Produce Moms got its start.
Thank you. You know, it started very grassroots, and we owe a debt of gratitude to everyone here in Indianapolis that helped us start. The Produce Mom started as a very basic WordPress blog in 2012 when I was marketing manager at Indianapolis Fruit Company. In 2015, I had the opportunity to buy the brand and buy the blog from my former employer. And so that's when I took my entrepreneurial leap, and my team and I have been building the Produce Moms ever since. And, you know, we've certainly grown into quite, you know, the emerging brand in agriculture and the grocery retail industry. And again, thank you so much to everyone in Indiana who has been a big part of that. We are the internet's number one destination for all things fruits and vegetables. So we're very proud of that at the Produce Moms.
All right, let's talk about your most recent success. The Produce Moms recently inked a deal, your first big business deal in the vegetable category for potatoes. So tell us about the new potato deal.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, we've been working with Wada Farms as one of our brand partners through our Produce Mom sponsorship programs for the last 4 years. Wada Farms is from Idaho. They're one of the largest potato growers in the world and a true leader in American agriculture. So they approached us last year with the idea and opportunity to co-brand or even just white label in a licensed branded deal, bring forward the Produce Moms brand on package with their individual Easy Baker russet potatoes. Those potatoes are sold nationwide coast to coast at Walmart. They are on shelf now at almost 40% of all of America's Walmarts. And we are expecting expansion very soon to additional retailers and of course an expanded footprint with Walmart stores as well.
Okay, and on those potatoes, on the logo, there's a QR code that shoppers can scan. And that really gets at the heart of your mission, which you say is to be an education hub. Can you talk just a little bit about what you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, I really believe, you know, as we strive forward with our quest to get more fruits and vegetables on every table, be that catalyst at the Produce Moms, I do believe it starts with education. People need to know how to select, store, and serve their fruits and vegetables as a means to increase consumption and volume and variety. Furthermore, people want to know where their food is from. They want to understand that supply chain and feel closer to the producers and the farmers. So through that QR code that appears on our licensed potatoes that are on shelf now at Walmart, you're going to be able to actually go right to the field in Idaho and watch a video on how these potatoes are grown and harvested and shipped to the grocery store. And we also have created a bunch of educational content on recipe inspiration, as well as, you know, fun activities that the children can do. And we've even worked with our in-house team of educators at the Produce Moms to make sure that all of our activity sheets and lesson plan ideas do meet national academic standards. So very proud of that.
And you were recently also named to the Forbes Next 1000, which recognizes small business owners who are disruptors in their industry. So can you explain how the Produce Moms is disrupting the produce industry?
Yeah, I mean, most of the companies we work with are at least 50 years old, if not approaching their centennial year of operation. American agriculture is really the foundation of industry, and agriculture worldwide is that. It's usually the first industry established in every single corner of this globe. So we have brought a very relevant way for the farmers to tell their messaging, and we have pushed on the supply chain by using that grassroots power that we have as one of the leading communities of moms on the internet. We have used that grassroots power to push on the supply chain to be more transparent about the practices. So it's been a very positive experience for all of our stakeholders, and we've really helped serve as that bridge. Through the Produce Moms, we are connecting the end consumer, the households, directly to the farmers.
And just a couple seconds left. You've done some great things locally. You got salad bars in every single IPS school. Just give us a quick snapshot of your global presence.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm very proud to represent the United States right now as the board member for Global Women Fresh. Global Women Fresh is our industry's leading global trade organization and non-for-profit that is focused on elevating women through the fresh produce industry. In many parts of the world, agriculture is the only industry that exists where a woman can earn a professional income and to hold the United States seat in any global arena is a great responsibility and privilege. So I very much enjoy working with my colleagues at the international level to make sure that we are fostering great strategies and opportunities to elevate women through agriculture around the world.
Well, Lori, congratulations on your successes. Thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Muncie Community Schools and Marion University are partnering in hopes of improving grades, bridging the achievement gap, and lowering dropout rates. They've launched a student support program called City Connects. Leanne Kwiatkowski with Muncie Community Schools and Jessica Morales-Most with Marion University detailed the program in our Eye on Education segment.
Jessica, I want to start with you. The City Connects program is part of a national program. I mentioned Massachusetts. I think it started at Boston College. But give us a thumbnail description of the City Connects program and really what it's all about.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us. So City Connects, as you said, based out of Boston College, started about 20 years ago in the Northeast region. And now we have, through a partnership with Boston College, have brought City Connects to the Midwest in the single largest expansion effort ever for the program, which is really exciting. We at Marion University and the Center for Vibrant Schools have launched a pilot program with 34 schools in the state of Indiana, in Gary, South Bend, Muncie, and Indianapolis. And through the City Connects practice, it's an evidence-based practice that ensures every single student in a school, no matter what kind of school it is, no matter what kind of students they serve, get the support they need. It's an evidence-based strategy that allows a clear, organized approach to ensuring student support is met for every single student. So it really becomes a hub of student support in your school by allowing out-of-school factors to be addressed for that of student success. So as you were saying before, there's a lot that students go through outside the classroom that impacts their success inside the classroom.
Yeah.
And thus this practice allows to bring all that together.
Very good. Andy, talk about why Muncie Schools was very interested in this. This is a program, and we'll get with Jessica in a moment on some of the outcomes seen in other places. But what's the need there, the demand for this type of program?
Well, of course, now is a rough time for education in general and for students who have additional worries on top of just learning in the classroom. And so this program comes along at a great time for us because this allows us to have a site coordinator currently in four of our schools and to be five by the end of the school year that can actually focus on needs of each student in that school and identify what their needs are beyond just academic help, beyond tutoring and where they may be having difficulties in their studies. This goes beyond that and really examines what else is going on. Maybe they have a health condition that has gone undetected, or there's something in their home that is keeping them from excelling in the classroom. And now we have somebody dedicated to identifying those situations and doing something about it.
Yeah, and as we were talking off camera a moment ago, this really does extend beyond the school into the community. I know the city of Muncie is a partner in this whole process, Ball State to an extent as well. So this is really a community connects, a community initiative.
It absolutely is in our community, and we have tremendous partners, tremendous support throughout Muncie for our school system, but this is just another way because the city helped fund these positions, these site coordinator positions that we have in four of our schools, five of our schools, and before long, thanks to Ball State. So we couldn't be more grateful for those, and I know that our site coordinators have been working hard since the start of the school year to identify the services that certain students need.
Yeah. Jessica, talk about some of the metrics, some of the performance of the City Connects program in Massachusetts and what some of the outcomes have been.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So in their recent report that's come out through the impact and the data that's been researched through City Connects, dropout rates have been cut by 50%, which is absolutely demonstrable for students. And then you think about absenteeism, making sure students are in their chairs in class every single day, because being more connected to your students and what they go through outside the classroom makes the student, his or herself, feel more connected to what's going on inside the classroom. So they want to come to school. So it improves absenteeism. One of the greatest notes is that it improves satisfaction and happiness amongst faculty, staff within your schools, because they too feel that they're having a greater impact on their students every single day because they see not just the academic improvement, but the social, emotional, behavior improvements as well.
Yeah, very quick. Only have about 20 seconds left, Jessica, but Marion on so many levels has been reaching out and extending its footprint on a statewide basis. As you look at this program, do you see this as something, as a pilot program, as becoming an annual program or a more sustainable program over time?
Absolutely. This is not just a program that's going to be around for 1 to 2 years. This is something that's going to sustain in perpetuity. And we want to see this in every school in the Midwest and across the nation, too. So this is just the beginning.
Very good. Jessica Morales Moss, Executive Director, K-12 Center for Vibrant Schools at Marion University. Andy Klotz from Muncie Schools. Interesting program. We look forward to watching the progress going forward. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
The Fort Wayne Comets are back on the ice and taking aim at another Kelly Cup Championship trophy. Play-by-play broadcaster Shane Alberani discussed the season and the state of the franchise with Bill Benner on Inside Indiana Sports.
24 years with the franchise, 8 years as the voice of the Comets. Just talk a little bit about hockey. You know, Fort Wayne is a hockey town, and they've always been a Comets town for all these 70 years.
Yeah. It's quite remarkable. The Comets are the second oldest minor league hockey franchise in North America. Only the Hershey Bears of the AHL has got a few years on us. And what's also more remarkable is that we've had the same owners for 32 years. And that's kind of unheard of. So I think that also plays into the loyalty of the fans. You know you're not going to have a new owner. You know things aren't going to change. And they really do take care of their fans. And that's why people keep on coming back. And plus, like you mentioned, we won a championship. So we're a winning franchise as well.
Well, and 10 overall titles. And like so many minor leagues, whether it's baseball, hockey, transitioning from leagues, started out with the International Hockey League, the United Hockey League, the Central Hockey League, and now in the ECHL, where the team won the Kelly Cup this past season.
Yeah, you're missing two other ones. You got the UHL and the IHL was reformed a few years later. So managed to be successful through all these leagues. And, back in the old IHL, it was AAA hockey, was one step below the NHL. And now, we went back to AA about 20, 25 years ago. So, even to make that transition as far as talent level wise, it's also remarkable because it actually has gotten more popular. It seems like year in and year out, and even, with the pandemic, we had a limited capacity last year for the regular season. But as soon as we were able to go back to full capacity, we had the place packed, 10,500 people for the finals. So, the Comets are so embedded in Fort Wayne. It is Fort Wayne. And that is the reason why also the Comets played, because a lot of teams in the ECHL didn't play. We only had 14 teams, and the Comets said, this community wants us to play. So we're going to play. And we're glad we did.
Yeah, and talk about the business of hockey weathering that COVID storm and so many franchises. And as you said, some of them didn't even perform last year, but it's a real testament to the Fort Wayne ownership that they persevered through all of that.
Yeah, no, it really was. It came down to the final really hours of letting the league know whether we were going to play or not. And it really came down to the fans wanted us to play. Our sponsors wanted us to play, and that was it. And plus, it was going to be, 70 years the following year, which we're celebrating now. And, there has been so many ups and downs through 70 years, and the Comets never missed a season, and we weren't going to let this stop us. So that's kind of another reason why we played.
obviously, we're based here in Indianapolis, Shane, but we have the Indy Fuel here performing in the Farmers Coliseum at the State Fairgrounds. Do we have an I-69 rivalry with the Fuel and the Comets?
Oh, yes, indeed we do. It goes back, a long, long time. It hasn't always been the Fuel. It's been the ice. It's been a few other things. But you know what? As long as there was a Fort Wayne team playing an Indy team, there's always going to be a rivalry. And, I look forward to going down to the Fairgrounds Coliseum. It's a place where I went to many times when I was a kid. I grew up in the 80s and early 90s, and we would make that trip as fans and a family so many times. So it's great memories walking into that building.
Shane, we got about 30 seconds left. So fill us in. Why is it Comets with a K?
Well, when the team first formed, a man by the name of Ernie Berg started the team. And to honor his wife, Catherine, he chose a K.
And there you have it.
There you have it.
There you have it. Well, Shane Alberani, the voice of the Fort Wayne Comets, we certainly appreciate you coming on the show. Best of luck. I know the team's off to a good start, and we look forward to seeing you against the Fuel at I-69 rivalry Wednesday, November 17th.
And finally this week, Indiana's most well-known business news brands are moving forward with their partnership. Inside Indiana Business and the Indianapolis Business Journal have begun their new journey together to bring you the most up-to-date and compelling business news. IBJ editor Leslie Weidenbenner has a look at what's ahead this week.
some interesting stories in the paper this week, and I love it, giving Doghouse a new meaning. And you're talking about apartment owners who are really catering to dog owners.
Absolutely. Developers, apartment developers can't get away anymore with these difficult policies that make it harder for pet owners to rent an apartment. And in fact, they've got to go the extra mile to create new amenities for pet owners.
So this really is a business decision. These apartments, because millennials, the stats show that they're pet owners.
So 90 million households in the U.S. have a pet. That was before the pandemic, and we all know that there are lots more pets now, and a third of those are millennials. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Indy Downtown estimates that in the city core, 60-some% of renters have pets.
Huh. That is interesting. Another hot topic, a talker, I think, in the paper this week will be the whole office versus remote debate that continues and will continue. What are you finding out?
Well, it's really interesting to see what's happening. So I think there's some 60% of remote white-collar workers say they're still working remotely. But companies are making different decisions. You know, we recently saw that Greenlight Guru actually doubled down. They expanded their offices downtown. But what they've said is they're going to go with a hybrid situation, but they wanted to have a great space for people to still collaborate. They thought that was important. Another company here in town, another software company, Decimal, they've decided to eliminate their office altogether. So I think you're seeing that companies are still just trying to find their way. And Susan Orr has got a great story in IBJ about that.
That's good. And here's one I know that people will be talking about, and that's vape shops selling this hemp derivative, right, that's being termed marijuana light.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago we were writing about what might happen in the marijuana debate, and our reporter Emily Ketterer came across the fact that this derivative, it's called Delta 8, is being sold in all kinds of products, gummies and all kinds of things. You can get it anywhere, and so far state officials don't seem to want to crack down on it. It was really made legal by the law a few years ago that allowed hemp products to be legal. And so, the state officials seem to be leaving it. Lots of states are writing laws to ban it, but not Indiana so far.
Yeah, the whole, I'm going off script here a little bit, but you're very connected politically. Do you anticipate the legislature is going to be dealing with more of these marijuana kind of related issues going forward?
Yeah, no doubt. I think the House in particular will probably be doing a lot of debating this year about marijuana legislation. Now, I'm not sure where it could go in the Senate. I don't know that this is the year when it could actually become law, but I think you're going to see a lot of debate.
Yeah. Hey, one more. I know you've got an environmental story in the paper this week that should probably raise a few eyebrows.
Absolutely. On East Washington Street, for decades, there's been this, they called it Black Mountain, a foundry sand, just a hill. Now, a lot of that was moved over and used as fill at the criminal justice campus. But that has left some environmental problems, and our reporter Leslie Bonilla has details about what's going to happen with that.
Great. Lots of great stuff in the paper this week. Leslie Weidenbender, great to have you on the show. Look forward to next week.
I really appreciate it.
That wraps up this week's Inside Indiana Business Television podcast. Remember, you can find all of this week's TV segments, as well as the top business news from throughout the state, at InsideIndianaBusiness.com. While you're there, you can also subscribe to our platform of free e-newsletters. This is Andy Ober for Inside Indiana Business.